On How Rude, Tanneritos, the Full House Rewatch podcast, join characters Stephanie Tanner and Kimmy Gibbler, also known as actresses Jodie Sweetin and Andrea Barber, as they relive every episode of your favorite Friday night comfort show.
We spent our entire childhoods on a little show called Full House, playing frenemies, but becoming besties whenever the cameras weren't rolling. And now, 35 years later, it's our biggest adventure yet.
Listen to How Rude, Tanneritos on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Craig Ferguson goes in search of joy in talks with actors, doctors, stand-ups, and scientists. Everyone. Is it love, religion, drugs, money? Where do you find it? Craig Ferguson, In Search of Joy, the celebrations, the dances, science, poetry, laughter, and music of joy. Don't miss it. Joy with Craig Ferguson. Hear it now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm here to help.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. In this week's episode, I had the honor to interview President Joe Biden in his first ever personal interview about mental health.
We have an enormous opportunity, but the thing I want to change is American attitude. We can do anything. There's nothing we've ever set our mind to we've not been able to do we've done together. For real.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I would have gotten off easier had I killed five people. When I was presented with this deal, they said, if you plead guilty, you'll be going to parole board in your early 50s. Well, I'm 53 years old right now. And instead of going to the parole board, I'm facing execution in less than 6 months. I would never spend the last 30 years in solitary confinement. The beatings, I went 20 years without touching my family. I've been on I don't know how many hunger strikes. I would never have to go through any of that had I pled guilty to these crimes I didn't commit, or had I actually killed five people. But if I plead guilty to murder, you're gonna run the time with the time on work. That's a hell of a deal for a mass murderer. But if you stand on your innocence, they say, oh, you want a trial? Okay, we're gonna give you a trial.
In part one of our coverage of Keith Lamar, we heard how he was offered a sentence that would run concurrent with the time he already had if he just agreed to plead guilty to 5 of the 10 murders that occurred during the Lucasville prison riot in 1993. For refusing this deal, he faced a capital murder trial. Now, we'll hear how law enforcement went through many rounds of interviews to find cooperating witnesses from the easily incentivized prison population to support their narrative that Keith had led or ordered other inmates to murder 5 men. We're going to examine how each witness drastically changed their stories from initial interviews to trial, what they stood to gain, as well as how the courts allowed prosecutors to withhold a vast trough of exculpatory evidence to ensure Keith Lamar's wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction and to part 2 of Keith Lamar's story. If you haven't listened to part 1, there's no time like the present. We now return to our interviews with Keith and his attorney, Keegan Steffen, who is heading up Keith's latest, and potentially his last, appellate effort. We previously left off talking about how 4 other men from 2 of the 3 factions involved in the Lucasville prison riot, the Aryan Brotherhood and Sunni Muslims, are currently on death row along with Keith, and how it appears that the 3rd faction, the Black Gangster Disciples, made a deal with prosecutors Mark Pietmeyer and Seth Teeger for cooperation in all 5 trials in exchange for either leniency or all-out immunity from their own actions.
It's an open secret. I mean, it was an article that was written on the 30th anniversary recently in Cincinnati Inquirer, and the prosecutor, Mark Pietmeyer, is on record. And he said, did I make the deal with the devil? Possibly. It's possible that the guy who maybe had blood on his hands is on the street right now, but that was the cards that we were dealt. You know, that's how the justice system works. It's first come, first serve. And, you know, the guy who Mark Pietmeyer was referring to in the article was Anthony LaVelle. He was the leader of the Black Gangster Disciples. Based on everything I've read, everything I've heard, you know, because it's been 30 years, he was the one who was really responsible for most of the killings, including the guard's death.
And so it appears that the leadership of the Black Gangster Disciples, Anthony LaVelle, Stacey Gordon, as well as others who were actually involved in the deaths on El Block, managed to avoid accountability by supporting the narrative that laid blame for all 10 deaths on the other four men and, of course, Keith. So let's talk about the investigation led by Hamilton County prosecutors Mark Pietmeyer and Seth Teeger. We remember their names from other wrongful convictions, including Elwood Jones, who they were totally willing to send to death row, even though they had scientific evidence of his innocence. So you could draw your own conclusions from that, as well as what you're about to hear. Now, it struck me as odd that they were involved in this case because Hamilton County is nowhere near Lucasville Prison.
Mark Pietmeyer, out of all the prosecutors in the state of Ohio, he was handpicked because of the record we now know he has, because he can put you on death row with no evidence. He could manufacture the evidence. He could withhold the evidence. This is what his office was known for doing. So it wasn't randomly picked. He was specifically picked because he had those skills.
It's pretty remarkable how many interviews they conducted and how uniform it is that almost all of the testifying witnesses followed the same arc. Initially, they were not naming Keith Lamar or even affirmatively saying that Keith was not involved. And then over time, as they gave more statements, started saying that Keith was involved and Keith was the leader of the death squad. You know, that is suspicious to say the least. And then almost all the witnesses to some degree also received deals and have incredible credibility issues.
So let's talk about those witnesses.
The testifying witnesses against Keith were Robert Bass, Anthony Walker, Thomas Taylor, Stacy Gordon, Lewis Jones, Ricky Rutherford, and Michael Childers. Many of the witnesses were transferred to Oakwood, which was a much more favorable facility for incarcerated people. Even the witnesses themselves testified that the guards were catering to their needs, giving them unlimited supplies of cigarettes, unlimited supplies at the canteen, extra visitation, jobs, and free range of movement.
And being in this better situation together, the witnesses were also able to, well, get their stories straight, right? To coordinate. But more importantly, almost all of those testifying witnesses had everything to gain. I mean, some of them had flat out admitted to killing one or more of the victims, and then they just shifted blame onto Keith, saying that he made them do it.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. Sort of even on the state's own theory, there is stronger evidence that other people were more directly involved in the murders of each one of the people for whom Keith was ultimately convicted of killing.
So Keith was charged with four murders from L Block: Daryl DePina, Bruce Vitale, William Svetti, and Albert Stayano. But let's start with the one from K Block, Dennis Weaver. Keith told the story of how he was piled into this cell on K Block with nine other guys when a Sunni Muslim named William Bowling, a.k.a. Shabazz, killed a man named Dennis Weaver along with two others, Ricky Rutherford and Michael Childers, who ended up testifying that Keith had told them to do it.
We've been able to find affidavits from one of the Muslims who was in the pod with William Bowling after Dennis was killed. And he encouraged William Bowling to say, listen, just say he made you do it. They already saying shit about him about the Elside murders.
And I have that 2005 affidavit right here from Abdul Muhammad Sadiq, who said that he had been previously threatened by Dennis Weaver. And he continued in the affidavit talking about the time he spent in the same cell with William Bowling in the aftermath of the riot. Now, Michael Childers was in a nearby cell as well. Sadiq said that Shabazz admitted to killing Weaver out of loyalty to him, a fellow Muslim whose life had been threatened by Weaver, a non-Muslim. Sadiq told Bowling, and this is a direct quote, that he should join with Childers and blame Lamar for the order, since Lamar was a non-Muslim and he was being seen as a ringleader for other inmate murders anyway, end quote.
And William Bowling, when it came time for him to testify against me on trial, he refused to come.
Right, but Michael Childers and Ricky Rutherford did testify. Keegan, what can you tell us about these two?
Yeah, so Ricky testified that Keith was the leader of the death squad, that Keith told him to tie up Weaver and that he did it. And then Keith told Childers to kill Weaver, which Childers did. Rutherford was transferred to Oakwood, where they were given preferential treatment and was charged with an aggravated murder. But the charge was reduced to involuntary manslaughter. And he received 5 to 25 years, but it was sort of intentionally meant not to increase the time that he would serve. The state also promised to let his cooperation be known to the parole board, provide him with counsel for his appearance before the parole board, and make all of the transcripts available to him.
So Rutherford admitted participating in Dennis Weaver's murder, completely removed William Bowling from the equation, and then, for the small price of saying Keith made us do it, he received a better prison assignment and effectively no additional sentence for the murder.
In addition, Rutherford is one of a couple testifying witnesses who suffered severe mental illness, auditory, visual, and command hallucinations, but those records were never turned over to the defense.
Jesus Christ. Okay, so what about Childers?
Michael Childers first said that other incarcerated people tied Weaver up. Then he said that he was told to kill Weaver, but when he went to do so, Weaver was already dead. Then ultimately, he admitted to killing Weaver, but said that Keith told him to do so. Again, he was charged with murder, but pled to involuntary manslaughter. Childers is another witness who was severely mentally ill. Medical records showed that he suffered hallucinations, and those medical records were not turned over to the defense, so the defense could not argue to the jury that this person was not a credible witness.
And again, the mental illness was the least of the credibility issues. Childers got a huge break in sentencing. Instead of murder, which is a capital offense, involuntary manslaughter, which is what he was charged with in Ohio, means 3 to 11 years. You can see that's a deal he certainly didn't want to refuse. All for the low, low price of blaming Keith for his own actions, alleging that he gave the order like some sort of prison gang leader, like Anthony LaBelle or Stacey Gordon of the Black Gangster Disciples, for example. Now, Stacey Gordon actually testified against Keith.
Yeah, so Stacey Gordon was one of the shot callers for the Black Gangster Disciples, is my understanding. He plainly admitted to helping to plan the uprising and to killing another incarcerated person, and yet was never charged for that. He was charged with assault on a corrections officer, but pled out and received 3 to 5 years to run concurrent with the sentence he was already serving. So he effectively served no time for this assault during an uprising that he admitted to planning.
So he got no time for either the assault or the murder. Wow. All right. So what testimony did he give in exchange for this phenomenal sweetheart deal that he got?
At trial, you know, Stacey Gordon is probably one of the more damning witnesses, and he describes Keith as the leader of the death squad. Again, it's sort of suspicious because other people identify Stacey Gordon as the person doing a lot of the things that Keith Lamar was ultimately pegged for doing, which was opening the cells that the alleged snitches were caged in, which was, in everybody's narrative, including the state's narrative, the step taken to lead to their executions. And it is in just direct contradiction to sworn testimony that he gave at his own guilty plea for the assault on the corrections officer, where he was asked if he saw Keith in L6 and said no.
So it sounds like he subbed Keith in for himself in the state's narrative at Keith's trial. And then the rest of the witnesses appear to serve that goal. A guy named Robert Bass testified, in addition to 3 more men who all appear to have been part of the death squad, Lewis Jones, Anthony Walker, and Thomas Taylor. So let's start with Robert Bass.
For Robert Bass in particular, he did not bring up Keith's name on his own. The transcript shows that one of the interviewing troopers brought up Keith's name, and then Robert Bass started saying it back to the interviewer. And this is like a classic example of a fed fact. That, you know, Bass didn't actually testify to seeing anyone assaulted or killed, but he said that Keith was in L6, that Keith had a t-shirt over his head, but was sure it was him. He also himself admitted to removing dead bodies from L6, but was never charged with any crime.
Bobby Bass, he was somebody who I was on speaking terms with. You know, during the riots, he fell down the steps, he was drunk or something, knocked all his teeth out. When he came to testify on me, he had all brand new false teeth. I mean, he looked at 20 years younger, you know. He looked at me. He one of the guys that looked at the table and hunched his shoulders like, I'm sorry. And he got released. He got an early release, man.
So he got his teeth fixed as well as an early release in exchange for some super vague testimony saying that your head was covered, but somehow he knew it was you. Maybe he was trying to make himself impeachable. Sounds that way, but okay, 4 down, 3 to go. Let's move on to Lewis Jones, Anthony Walker, and Thomas Taylor. And we're going to do this by going victim to victim in L block. Bruce Vitale, William Svetti, Albert Stayano, and Daryl DePina.
For Daryl DePina, you know, there were other incarcerated people who made statements saying that Lewis Jones was the person who killed Daryl DePina. Lewis Jones' statements changed dramatically over time. He admitted to being a part of the death squad and listed everyone else involved, which is a sort of rare statement for someone to give off the bat for an incarcerated person. But he didn't name Keith. He said that the group was led by a black Muslim. Lamar was not a black Muslim. And then ultimately, you know, testified that Lamar was the leader of the death squad. Other incarcerated people identified Jones as being involved in not just the murder of Daryl DePina, but Bruce Vitale. And despite that, despite him admitting that he was a member of the death squad and knew everyone else involved and being implicated in two murders, he was never charged in connection with the uprising in any way.
Wow, he named everybody in the death squad in his first interview and excluded Keith, information that was hidden by the state. And then for his testimony, he was transferred to Oakwood and was not charged for two murders, Daryl DePina and Bruce Vitale. And I understand that another individual, Aaron Jefferson, was named along with Lewis Jones for Daryl DePina. And then there were additional people named in connection with Bruce Vitale's death.
Yeah. So with Bruce Vitale, there is not strong and credible evidence against Keith. However, there are other statements in the record that two other incarcerated people were the actual people who killed Bruce, who were not charged with this crime.
Now, let's move on to the murder of William Svetty.
A person named Eric Gertie later admitted and pled guilty to this, had to give a colloquy about the details of the murder that had to be accepted by the court. And he specifically said that Keith was not involved. That would seem to be pretty important exculpatory evidence that should be a basis for reversing this conviction, but the courts didn't see it that way.
And in addition to Gertie, there were court filings naming three other individuals in Svetty's murder: Fred Frakes, Roger Snodgrass, and Brian Eskridge. Yet none of those alternative suspects were known to the jury or the defense. So moving on to Albert Stayano, for this one, the last two witnesses, Anthony Walker and Thomas Taylor, kind of tag-teamed this one.
Yeah. Walker initially told investigators that a number of people participated in the beatings and murders in L Block, but said that Keith was not present. Ultimately, however, he said that Keith was involved, and so he just switched in Keith for other people in his narrative and ultimately testified that Keith was the leader of the death squad. Keith handed someone a bat and told him to when he had earlier said that was someone else entirely.
So this is another time Keith was specifically excluded, but the state withheld it from the defense. And then Walker joined the crowd, swapping in Keith for the actual assailants in exchange for no charges for his own actions. Then Thomas Taylor testified to receiving and using the bat that Walker mentioned.
So Thomas Taylor admitted to murdering Stayano. He said that he alone hit the victim over the head with a bat repeatedly until the bat cracked, but he said that Keith told him to. And yet Taylor was able to plead to involuntary manslaughter while Keith received a capital murder charge and conviction.
Taylor made about eight statements. In his first three statements, he was non-committal. The fourth statement, he said he saw Keith Lamar and Stacy Gordon. He said Gordon is the leader of the death squad. And then his fifth statement, Stacy Gordon completely disappears from the narrative because Stacy Gordon, too, has now become a state's witness.
This podcast is brought to you by Ohio Justice and Policy Center, a nonprofit law firm that seeks justice for people directly impacted by Ohio's criminal legal system. OJPC provides free legal services to currently and formerly incarcerated people. Through its Beyond Guilt project, OJPC works to free overpunished people who have rehabilitated themselves. OJPC's Second Chance Clinics help individuals with criminal records remove barriers to employment and housing. OJPC's Human Rights in Prison Project represents people who face denial of medical care. In its 25-year history, OJPC has worked at the policy level and won numerous victories in Ohio, including ending juvenile life without parole and exempting seriously mentally ill people from the death penalty. To learn more about Ohio Justice and Policy Center and how you can support its mission, visit ohiojpc.org. That's ohiojpc.org. Ohio Justice and Policy Center. We don't write people off.
They took a group of prisoners and they put them in a private prison here in Ohio. And there they went over a script. Pete Maher ate Thanksgiving dinner with these prisoners. They had movies. They had the free run of the commissary. And these same witnesses would carry from trial to trial, saying the same story over and over again. Now, we're talking about a riot. We're talking about people being murdered with shovels and bats and knives. But it's also this very clean group of witnesses who were standing back watching the whole thing, going from murder to murder, according to the state. But it wasn't a neat thing. It couldn't have been a neat thing. It was a riot. Meanwhile, you know, the boots, my clothes, when I came out the yard, all those things were burned.
You can kind of see the reasoning for viewing evidence that had been on L Block for an 11-day siege as not probative, but not so with the inmates on the yard or in K Block. And in the state's narrative, Keith was either ordering or leading the charge on several of these murders on L Block before returning to the yard. He didn't have a change of clothes. If he had anything to do with his death squad, his boots and clothing clearly would have been covered in at least some of the victim's DNA.
Yeah, you would imagine, you would think if I'm responsible for the death of five people, you would think I would have some blood, some kind of, you know, scratches on my body, something.
Yeah, the fact that they didn't save the clothing is more and more shocking. The state took that piece of evidence, probably the most crucial piece of evidence in this case, and burned it.
You know, they alleged that stuff papered down Dennis Weaver's throat and never presented the piece of paper with my DNA on it.
Yeah, the paper that you allegedly stuffed down Dennis Weaver's throat to suffocate him. I mean, that piece of alleged evidence somehow magically disappeared as well.
So out of 22,000 pieces of evidence that was collected, all of it was burned.
And those weren't the only dirty tricks,
no,
right?
They took my case to Lawrence in Ohio, 96% white, and paneled an all-white jury. But that was only the beginning. They went through this very one-way discovery.
You know, when I first read about this pretrial discovery process, I was dumbfounded as to how this was allowed to happen. The prosecution had amassed hundreds of interviews. But when Keith's attorneys made the request for any exculpatory evidence, you know, saying that Keith wasn't involved, first they objected.
The prosecutors objected, saying, you know, it's going to be hard to satisfy their constitutional requirement to find all of the exculpatory material in their mountains of evidence. That's obviously not an excuse, but the judge accepted that justification and said, turn over what you can. And what followed was the prosecutor saying, you know, we don't want to turn over all of the statements with the names attached, because we think that that could put some of the incarcerated people's safety in jeopardy. And so they got together the statements that they deemed exculpatory, and the judge read them into the record without the names attached.
There's a bit to unpack about what you just said. They handed over what they deemed exculpatory. And with what we've already examined here, they left out some absolute fucking whoppers. And then I understand that the defense was given a list of 43 names that were not matched up with the statement summaries that the prosecution actually did provide for the judge to read into the record. And then most, if not all, of those 43 men wouldn't cooperate with Keith's defense.
If the witness statements are not attached to names, so you can't cross-examine the testifying witnesses and can't go interview and call witnesses of your own that have testimony that is helpful for you, then those disclosures are not satisfying the purpose of Brady. They're not allowing you to present a defense.
And what Pete Maher later admitted at a federal habeas hearing in 2007 was that they used an impossibly narrow standard to deem a statement exculpatory. Essentially, he said that since these were group murders, if Keith was not specifically excluded, then it does not exclude Keith. But we know from examining the interview transcripts that they didn't even satisfy their own standard. Lewis Jones and Anthony Walker both specifically excluded Keith. Stacy Gordon's testimony in his assault charge proceeding also excluded Keith. But this was all still hidden from the defense, despite meeting this very narrow Brady standard.
Again, the purpose of Brady, the reason you get exculpatory material, is so that you can present a defense. Anybody looking at that today, any lawyer, any judge, would say that doesn't satisfy Brady.
So with these built-in constitutional violations, Keith went to trial with the judge having read these statement summaries unattached to names into the record, the ones that Pete Maher and Tiger deemed exculpatory. And the statement summaries varied from useless to speculative to
actually exculpatory. For example, referring to an alleged witness of Dennis Weaver's death in cell K-236, quote, "He was in a cell adjoining K-236 but gave no useful information," end quote. Another example, quote, "He was in an adjoining cell to K-236 and heard a commotion and thought Weaver hung himself," end quote. And then the actually useful exculpatory material, quote, "He observed Eskridge kill Svetty in L corridor," end quote. Now, if you remember, there were four men associated with Svetty's death: Eskridge, Frakes, Snodgrass, and Gertie, the last of which ultimately confessed and excluded Keith. So this is the total extent of the material that was shared with the defense, along with a list of 43 names of possible sources for those statements. The defense, meanwhile, was expected to go to trial blindfolded with both hands tied behind their backs. But even still, they did present an alibi.
Yeah, so, you know, Keith testified and had a number of defense witnesses: Kurt Ayers, Ronnie Eugene Foreman or Foots, Corey Perkins, William Washington, also known as Gino, and Christopher Eugene Williams. Basically, all of the defense witnesses corroborated Keith's story. Like in so many wrongful convictions and exonerations, you know, the defendant had a bunch of alibi witnesses. They all seemed credible. They all confirmed his story. They said that he was in the yard during the time when the murders occurred.
Unfortunately, once again, without knowing everything we laid out earlier about the witnesses, or even with the concocted discovery that Keith did get, the jury was primed to buy the state's narrative. And with the exception of Robert Bass, all of them testified, transferring the blame for their own crimes right to Keith. And since all of the physical evidence had been destroyed, there was no way to either confirm or deny it.
Because they did at one point roll a whole bunch of wheelbarrows and shovels and fire extinguishers wrapped in plastic, giving the jury the impression that these are the murder weapons, hammers and shanks and all this shit wrapped in plastic, as if they had did a meticulous investigation. Shit didn't have anything to do with anything, you know, but no one was there to see that. Throughout the whole trial, which lasted a month, there was no one in the gallery. You know, it was empty. And the jury found me guilty. I went back to Lucasville for a month. I came back for sentencing. And I had, you know, written and memorized this little speech that I wanted to say. And I came out to the courtroom, man. It was about 300 white people standing in there. And suits, man, and Easter clothes. I mean, and it was standing room only. And I hadn't seen iconic pictures in the 1800s, 1700s of black people being lynched. And you had this big gathering, big swarm of white people standing around with ties on. It was the same thing. And when I seen them pictures a couple of years later, I knew I'd seen that before. I said, you know, I witnessed that. And I was a part of that. I know what that is. That's a lynch mob.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. In this week's episode, I had the honor to interview President Joe Biden in his first ever personal interview about mental health. The president opens up about grief, connection, the childhood battles that have shaped him, personal mental health, and mental health at large. You don't want to miss it.
The day will come when you open that closet door and you smell the fragrance of her dresses, or you're going by that park where you walked with your child or your wife or your husband, or the thing that reminds you. And for the longest time, it'll just bring a tear to your eye. But eventually, every once in a while, it'll bring a smile to your lips before it brings a tear to your eye. When that happens, you know you're going to make it. I mean, it doesn't mean you still don't cry. It doesn't mean the pain still isn't real, even years later. But you know you can make it.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Craig Ferguson, the Grandmaster, the Architect of Wisdom, Maharishi of Mirth, goes in search of joy.
I'm here to help.
He'll be speaking with actors, doctors, comedians, and scientists, artists, and athletes, and people of faith in search of extreme happiness.
The United States of America are crowned champions of the world.
At last, a podcast on a mission, a podcast that wonders what is joy. Is it love, religion, drugs, success, money, revenge? Is it a surge of chemicals or a deeper awakening? Can it be nurtured, cultivated, and refined? Find out as Craig Ferguson explores the countless ways people find joy. The celebrations, the dances, the science, poetry, laughter, and music of joy. Don't miss it. Joy with Craig Ferguson. Hear it now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a special transmission from M
and Jem, and we're setting the navigation back to Earth.
Why? You promised we would stop on Zorp for those flangle fries.
We can go back for them later. We need to pick up some clean suits and fuel up, because we have a lot more flights to do, and we start now.
Oh? Who's flying with us this time? Tell me.
You know that's classified information, but soon all shall be revealed.
Ooh, do I still get my sound effects buttons?
Unfortunately.
Yes. Games?
Oh, yeah.
And can we have a real alien on this time around?
Honestly, that might be a real possibility with how things are looking.
Woo!
Strap in tight and join us for season 2 of In Our Own World, part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
See you soon.
The most important thing I've learned is that who I am is more important than what I have. And if I am who I say I am, then it doesn't really matter where I am. I can still be who I am. I mean, I'm in a fucked up situation. There's no way to sugarcoat that. I've been inside taking fine for all these years, but I am not the situation. The situation is fucked up. I'm not fucked up. I make sure that I'm not fucked up. I have a routine. I've learned how to meditate when I was in my early 20s. And I was lucky. Jason, I met and was mentored by some very remarkable men here in prison, father figures. One was my boxing coach, and this other guy named Dae was like a philosopher, poet, you know, kind of turned me on to a lot of literature and was like a therapist as well, kind of helped me deal with some of the trauma. And then when I arrived on death row, I met another older guy named Snoop, who I referenced in the music, in the album that we put out, the Freedom First album. You know, these mentors showed me how to do yoga, how to actually live. And, you know, I was able to pursue myself even in this little space. You know, I started developing my inner life. You know, I have a rich inner life. You know, I've read, you know, close to 2,000 books, man.
And I have to ask, Keith, of the close to 2,000 books that you've read, which one had the most profound impact on you?
Well, one of the things that I was given to understand that if I wanted to change my situation, I had to learn how to write. Now, mind you, I dropped out of school in 10th grade. And so one of the books that I read that taught me how to write was Richard Wright's Black Boy. I read that book every day for, you know, a few years. I was reading with the intent of learning how to write. And so reading that is how I ultimately became a writer myself and wrote my memoir, Condemned, which chronicles, you know, my journey through the criminal justice system on death row.
This is the most important part of the story, in my opinion, right? Of course, I'm talking about your poetry, your performances, music, writing. You wrote Condemned, as I understand it, in solitary confinement on a typewriter a few pages at a time, right? And dictated it every morning by telephone to somebody who transcribed each and every word. You founded a literacy program, learned to play chess, yoga, meditation. I mean, I think most people are listening and trying to think which people from their life, you know, friend circle has accomplished what you've accomplished.
And I'm doing the same that you are trying to do, Jason, that, you know, anybody else trying to do. You're trying to make the most out of your one and only life. And the circumstances are different, yes, but the goal is the same, is to do something righteous with my life.
Tell us, what is Native Sons? That's a literacy program that you founded?
Yeah, the Literacy Project. You know, Richard Wright, as I said, man, had a big impact on my life. Not just on my writing, but just on how to engage with life. And I just thought that if I had read that book when I was 13 in a juvenile, that it probably would have changed something in terms of my self-concept and how I looked at life. And so I just started reading with high school students in the inner cities here in Ohio and New York City. And it's been really, really a rewarding experience.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's kind of like you're reaching back, almost like trying to help your younger self. And you've been doing that and so much more with one of the unsung heroes of your story,
Amy Gordeyev. She helps facilitate the literacy program events. She's the person that transcribed your memoir, Condemned, over the phone, as well as advocated for you to us and Leah Rothman of the Real Killer podcast. She's also the person that facilitates what you mentioned earlier, and I'm talking about Freedom First, which started as a concert series with New York-based jazz musicians and you on the phone from death row sharing poetry and spoken word. You've done shows literally, like, it seems like all over the world, from your cell. It's really incredible what you've been able to accomplish.
You know, because I have time. You know, these people have given me time, you know, and given me really a gift of time.
It's truly amazing to hear your perspective, and I believe I could come around to it being a gift, if not for the fact that you have to also spend that gift of time fighting for your freedom and your life. Your very life. So let's turn to your appeals. There were a number of potential constitutional violations, like whether or not some jurors were excluded due to racial bias. But the main issue was and is the withholding of exculpatory evidence. But this issue is kind of split into two parts. The first, whether or not the way in which the information that was shared with the defense at trial constituted a Brady violation. The landmark Supreme Court case that ruled that the state must turn over all evidence that might exonerate the defendant. And if you remember, the judge read statement summaries detached from their sources.
The appellate court said these statements were turned over. That ignores the fact that they were turned over in such a way that they couldn't satisfy the very basic premise of Brady, that they're turned over in a way to defend yourself.
Right. How was he supposed to defend himself with these sort of phantom statements with no names attached? So how did the ruling get around that obviously clearly logical conclusion?
They said that they weren't exculpatory, which sort of follows the prosecutor's very narrow definition of Brady, which is that they weren't exculpatory because they said that other people did it, but they didn't say that Keith didn't do it.
Which is patently ridiculous. There were plenty of people in that prison, 1,819 to be exact, and they weren't specifically excluded either. And so what did the court say to address that?
They said it wasn't material under Brady. And material under Brady is effectively, if it wouldn't have changed the outcome of trial, then it's not material. And so we don't need to reverse a conviction based on the fact that these statements weren't turned over in a usable fashion.
So that refers to what Pete Meyer and Teeger did turn over at trial. And then comes the second Brady issue. The exculpatory evidence that was withheld from the defense and later discovered by two attorneys who were appointed to handle Keith's federal appeal, Kate McGarry and David Daughton. Now, they turned up the initial witness statements that we revealed earlier, and at least two of those satisfy even the very narrow thread-the-needle Brady standard that Pete Meyer and Teeger devised. Anthony Walker and Lewis Jones both named everyone in the death squad and specifically excluded Keith. And then there's the statements about Stacy Gordon.
There were statements from other incarcerated people saying that Gordon opened the cells that the alleged snitches were placed in and was the leader of the death squad, which is basically what Keith was convicted of. Gordon himself admitted to killing another incarcerated person.
And then was never charged with that murder, but rather with assault of a corrections officer with a sentence to run concurrent, by the way, with the time he already had. And then at that assault proceeding, Gordon specifically excluded Keith.
So that is, again, very clear material Brady evidence.
But the state courts heard all of that and didn't think even one juror would have thought it mattered at the time, even though that's all it takes to change an outcome at trial.
Exactly.
I was told not to expect any relief from the state courts. I thought I would receive relief once I got to the federal court. And I'm the only one out of all the Lucasville prisoners who were granted an evidentiary hearing. We've been back in 2007, I believe it was, and put Pete Meyer on the stand.
And this was when he came clean about the impossibly narrow standard by which they deemed something exculpatory.
Right. I mean, it's a strange thing that the courts did in reviewing those statements, right? They bought Pete Meyer's logic and said that if a statement said that some people committed the murder but didn't directly exclude Keith, then it wasn't exculpatory. Okay.
But Pete Meyer and Teeger did withhold statements that were not absolved by this ridiculous standard, statements that did specifically exclude Keith. And yet, the federal and state courts both did the same thing, saying that the statements from Anthony Walker, Lewis Jones, and Stacy Gordon wouldn't have made a difference at trial.
So Keith's habeas was denied in 2011, as was the appeal in 2015. And in 2016, the Supreme Court denied certiorari, refusing to review the evidence and the lower court's decision. Separately, there's been an ongoing legal battle over the lethal injection protocol in America. Essentially, the rest of the world is so disgusted by us that they've been trying to starve us of the drugs that were deemed to be, quote, humane, a ridiculous word for this, and approved thereby for use in our lethal injection protocols. And I'm talking about sodium thiopental or pentobarbital, the anesthetic acting as the first drug in the three-drug cocktail. By 2014, states began to run out of the drug, and so they started looking for alternatives like midazolam, which then triggered legal challenges from those facing the death penalty. The thing is, with midazolam, in many cases, the condemned have suffered and writhed in agony on the gurney for the better part of an hour, which one would think would constitute a violation of the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment. But our current Supreme Court did not agree. However, this long legal battle over the injection protocol did have the positive effect of halting executions, even if only temporarily. In the meantime, for Keith, after his federal habeas was denied, he fired his attorneys and his case was given to the Tennessee federal defenders. But with midazolam cleared for use by the Supreme Court of the United States, various states that still have capital punishment began setting execution dates again, including Ohio, which caused an imminent and very real threat to Keith's life that has since been averted, and we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's get to the Tennessee federal defenders.
The Tennessee federal defenders took over the case. They did successfully get access to additional files that the appellate counsel did not have access to. We're now going to be reviewing those. They were going to attempt to bring an actual innocence claim. They recognized that it needed to happen in state court first, but their jurisdiction is limited to federal court, so they were not able to make that motion. So since then, you know, Keith has needed someone to come in who would be able to make a motion in state court to bring in any newly discovered evidence.
And that's where you and the team at Beldock, Levine, and Hoffman come in.
Yes. Yeah, so David Singleton at the Ohio Justice and Policy Center is our local counsel. And then we're also working with Joshua Jack Jones at Northwestern Law School. We've now gotten all the materials from the Tennessee federal defenders. In the process of digitizing all of that, we have an army of attorneys and student attorneys now that are going to be reviewing it in tandem, using a coding system to bubble everything up to get the attorneys that'll be writing the brief.
So there are still some promising legal avenues available, along with the potential for additional exculpatory material that you have already. And now, Governor DeWine has granted Keith a reprieve. It's cold comfort, but still. And it's insane that it ever got this close. But Keith had a scheduled execution date of November 16th, 2023. But now his team has a real chance to litigate his case. And we are hoping against hope that justice delayed will not be justice denied. So what can our audience do to help?
You can go to my website, keithlamar.org, or follow me on Facebook, Justice for Keith Lamar. There's a petition on those various pages that you can sign that was submitted to the governor just to indicate to him how many people are aware of my situation and who are watching the decisions that he makes regarding my situation.
All right, we're going to have action steps linked in the bio. It's important to note that Justice for Keith Lamar is a nonprofit 501c3. There will also be ways that you can delve even deeper into this case, including another podcast, the entire second season of The Real Killer with journalist and host Leah Rothman. We're also going to link to Keith's book, his upcoming shows, and how you can experience his work and get involved. So with that, we come to my very favorite part of the show. Closing arguments. First of all, I thank each of you. Then I'm going to kick back in my chair, turn my microphone off and leave my headphones on, probably close my eyes, and just listen for anything else you want to share with me and our incredible audience. So Keegan, why don't you go first? Then Keith, you'll take us off into the sunset.
Keith is innocent, and at minimum, he did not receive a fair trial. He needs to finally get a fair look at his case by a court. You know, I think Keith has said it best. He's not asking any attorney to promise that he will get exonerated. He wants us to create a document that lays out his story, shows just how many constitutional violations occurred in his trial, just how much exculpatory evidence there is, and put that in front of a judge and make a judge look at all of that and say, we're going to put you to death anyway. Keith wants his story out there. He wants, if he's executed, this to be something that people look back on and say, look, that shows just how inhuman this system was, just how doomed this civilization was, that it would put people to death based on trials that were egregiously unfair. And I think that Keith's trial was egregiously unfair, and we're coming in to try to right that. Unfortunately, our only method of righting that is to find new evidence outside of that trial, get back into court, exonerate Keith, and stay his execution.
As I'm talking about all this shit, it's a lot too, man, that, you know, to kind of, you know, if you didn't have the statements, if they threw away all the statements like they did, threw away all the physical evidence, no one would believe this story. But lo and behold, this mountain of evidence, you know, all this shit. So for no other reason, the world want to know about this, what happened to me, what they did to me. And it might be, you know, I might find myself strapped to a gurney, but it won't be because I went to death row and laid down and watched their color television. It won't be because I sat down in that cell and didn't open up a legal book, that I didn't do everything that I possibly could in furtherance of my own life. And it won't be because the public didn't know about what they did. But that's what this podcast is about. That's what the book is about. That's what the documentary is about. That's all what that's all about. They won't be able to call this justice. Now, I might not be prevent them from executing me. These people have been killing. They're good at that. They're efficient at executing people, lynching people. And I would join the ranks of my ancestors. That's how I look at that. If shit that happened, I'm doing everything to prevent that from happening, you know. But one thing for sure, they won't be able to call this justice, though. And that's my goal. And so I've been retrying my case in the court of public opinion. And it's a hard sell until you read the evidence. You know, you have it right there in your hand, you know. I didn't have that. The jury didn't see that. Not that it would have made a difference. But we live in a different era now, and I'm hoping that people in today's era, after seeing George Floyd, Eric Garner, Breonna Taylor, so on and so forth, that they would, you know, respond differently to this evidence and not say that it doesn't mean anything. Because obviously, I came to prison and did something with my life. I rehabilitated myself, and if that's what this is about, then I have done that. I'm a perfect candidate for redemption. We all have to be given the chance to learn from our mistakes and become a benefit to our communities and whatnot. I can do that if given the chance, if that's what we say we truly are about. I dedicated the past 2 decades of my life mentoring young people in the same situation I was in when I was 13 years old. And with no incentive, my beard hasn't gotten any softer because of these things I've been doing. I'm doing because it's in my heart to do that. Because I had a recognition that this is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life, in spite of the bullshit that happened to me.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Andy Chelsea, and Lila Robinson, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
On How Rude, Tanneritos, the Full House Rewatch podcast. Join characters Stephanie Tanner and Kimmy Gibbler, also known as actresses Jodie Sweetin and Andrea Barber, as they relive every episode of your favorite Friday night comfort show.
We spent our entire childhoods on a little show called Full House, playing frenemies, but becoming besties whenever the cameras weren't rolling.
And now, 35 years later, it's our biggest adventure yet.
Listen to How Rude, Tanneritos on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Craig Ferguson goes in search of joy in talks with actors, doctors, stand-ups, and scientists. Everyone. Is it love, religion, drugs, money? Where do you find it? Craig Ferguson, In Search of Joy, the celebrations, the dances, science, poetry, laughter, and music of joy. Don't miss it. Joy with Craig Ferguson. Hear it now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm here to help.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. In this week's episode, I had the honor to interview President Joe Biden in his first ever personal interview about mental health.
We have an enormous opportunity, but the thing I want to change is American attitude. We can do anything. There's nothing we've ever set our mind to we've not been able to do we've done together. For real.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.